usually come up with a big tune, but not today. Something a little more subtle. Do you know your sonatas? Well, here's one. A lot of people know this by knowing it, but they don't know the name of it. So it's the Moonlight Sonata, and we'll just let it play underneath us while we talk about what I'd like you to consider today. Ludwig von Beethoven. It's known to us the same way that Taylor Swift is known to us. I mean, we assume, but we don't really know very much. Where was he born? He was born in Bonn. That's Germany. And he made his name as a prodigy in Vienna, where a terrible thing happened. He began, even as a young man in his 20s, to lose his hearing. And it was only then, with all his talent under siege, that he began to pump out the work of a genius. The work of ages. The work which began to live on without him. 9 symphonies, endless sonatas. This is one of them, perhaps the most famous. A number of nocturnes, an opera, a mass. And he became, in his misery, a superstar that we think we know, or assume we do. Can you see that picture of him? His hair combed back from a broad, strong forehead, that intense Beethoven glare defining his face. His mood and his dynamic volume of work, all there before who came after. His ears tried to silence him, but nature had another plan. No, he would never hear what was to be said about his work in the centuries to come. But he got it out before he lost his hearing. He just wrote it down. Let nature take its course. Ludwig von Beethoven. You think we know about him, but I wonder. What about this next guy, Alexander Borodin? I had to look him up. He was a chemist, he was a physician, and then when he had a little time on his hands, he would write music when he was sick or otherwise unplugged from his scientific work. And he would have been astounded to learn that his music was used in the 1953 Broadway play called Kismet. What would Borodin have to do with ladies coming into town to see a show? Coming in to see Kismet without a clue about the chemist and the doctor, they're all wrapped up in one man, who was mentioned in a poem by the unruly Charles Bukowski, and it reads like this. Next time you listen to Borodin, remember his wife used his compositions to line the cat box and to cover jars of sour milk. She had asthma and insomnia, and she fed him soft-boiled eggs no matter what he wanted for dinner. When he wanted to cover his head to shut out the sounds of the house, she allowed him only a sheet. Besides, there was usually somebody in the bed, and all the chairs were taken, so he slept in the stairway, wrapped in an old shawl. And she told him when to cut his nails, and she told him not to sing, and she told him not to whistle or put too much lemon in his tea, and don't press it with a spoon. Borodin, he could only sleep by putting a piece of dark cloth over his eyes, so says Charles Bukowski. I wonder what the maestro says. He's here with us. Nicholas Kawili, the music director and the conductor. Well, the Wenatchee Valley Symphony is in our... Otherwise, why would I be talking about these people? Is that correct, Nicholas?
That's right.
Why would I ever mention these guys? Well, they're fascinating people, and you're going to deal with their music soon.
Right. So we're going to do our concert 2 of our 72nd season with the Wenatchee Valley Symphony, and we're featuring 2B composers, Beethoven and Borodin, on their second symphonies. They're both second symphonies, but they're both... very, very different in the way they tackle this genre.
What did Beethoven want to do when he wrote his second symphony? He had only written one, I guess, or maybe some practice.
Well, if you think of it this way, you know, Haydn wrote 104 symphonies.
Wow.
Mozart wrote 41 symphonies, and Beethoven only wrote 9. It's not that he became lazier. Or was not as...
he was fed up with the symphony business.
As his predecessors, but he just made each symphony much more profound, much deeper, much more complicated in its structure, and they are all quite a bit longer, especially his 9th symphony, which is about 75 minutes long.
So these were great works.
Everyone would point to Beethoven's 9 symphonies as the definitive collection that kind of spurned symphonists after him. Sibelius, Mahler, Brahms, Bruckner, all these other symphonists looked to these 9 as kind of their roadmap, you know, their model. Let's first try to do what Beethoven did, and then let's next try to build upon that.
It's like trying to play baseball like the Red Sox on your first day out.
That's exactly right.
You want to be a baseball player? Play like the Red Sox. You want to write symphonies? Write like Beethoven.
Exactly.
Now, did he do a lot of rewriting? Do we know? Did he go back and redo it and get it right?
Yeah, you can look this stuff up. You can actually see pictures of Beethoven's penmanship, his style. You know, it's different than Bach, who kind of just like diarrhea, just kind of put all the stuff on paper, and it's just really beautiful, no scratches.
Mathematically perfect.
Yes, exactly. Mozart the same way, beautiful penmanship. Beethoven was not so. He was scratching all the time, scratching things out, reworking fragments. You know, there's seemingly no organization to it. And so when we see these publishers actually put this stuff together and create plates of this music and create beautiful printed scores, there's a lot of, the critical editions come with notes that are probably as long as the symphony itself, because it refers to many different sources, places where he wrote an F, but it could have been a P, places where he put a staccato, or it could have been just a spill from his ink blot, all kinds of things on authorities on how these scores really should be played.
Did he have anyone helping him who said, Ludwig, let me clean this up so the orchestra can has a chance to figure out what you meant?
These guys are on their own. No assistants. Wow. You know, they do have students. They're teaching them piano. They're teaching them violin and composition. But, no, not like today. You know, John Williams has a staff of a dozen arrangers and orchestrators that, you know, he can scribble his tune on a napkin, give it to them, and then they just kind of flesh it all out for the movie.
They orchestrate it, and it looks beautiful.
It looks beautiful.
Did Beethoven resent or bemoan the fact that he was losing his hearing? He must have known that he was having trouble, and did it spur him on to create more?
This is true. I mean, and this actually defines what most people call the three stages of Beethoven's output. There's an early, there's a middle, and then there's a late. And right before the middle stage, he actually writes down on paper in a very, very personal letter, the Heilige Stadt Testament, describing his impending hearing loss and how difficult it was to wrap his head around that, and how depressing, how distraught he was knowing that this was going to be taken away from him, especially as a musician. But the second symphony that we're playing now, he still had that, had full hearing. And so you can actually hear that in his music. The music is more light. It's more, joyful. There's a lot more jokes in it, kind of like his teacher, Joseph Haydn. But when you hear the music, post the Heilige Stadt Testament, you hear something much grittier, much more personal, much more contrasting in terms of dynamics, highs and lows, and you really can hear his heart in his music.
He was a fascinating guy because he's become a product. We think we know Beethoven just because we know his name, but to study all his works is to study the work of a genius, a madman, or all of the above.
Yes, like I said, all these composers, they just look to this person, and he was just, in some ways, just a servant. You know, he's a public servant, with his compositions. He paid for his works too with patrons who, asked him to write these things. So some of this was just normal employment, just a way of life. And some of this was art as well. But you have to study his music. You're also studying his personality, which was just so dramatic.
How long is the second symphony that you're going to do?
The second symphony is on the shorter side. You know, I think as you go from 1 to 9, they progressively get longer. 3 is probably his third symphony is probably the exception. It's a longer one before a short one in the fourth symphony. So I'd say that the second symphony is about 30 minutes long, and that's actually quite short compared to those by Bruckner and Mahler, who went, you know, almost up to 80 minutes long, 90 minutes long in some of their symphonies.
Is it important to just study it in detail and get it right, or is it important for you to interpret it? Which do you do?
Well, as a student of composition and as a student of conducting, I look at that score and, of course, all those critical additions that remark about its authorship. I look at it as DNA. You know, here are the blueprints for what this should sound like. I mean, there's tempo markings, there's notes, there's dynamics, and it's up to us to realize this blueprint. Of course, as we're vessels of for music, for sound, and how this is expressed over time, these blueprints become interpreted through our bodies, yeah. Right? I'm a short person or shorter person, so I might move in a certain way, different than another person. We also have a different kind of acoustic hall. We have different kinds of community musicians. So all those variables together mean we have an interpretation of this music. But we'd like to say to ourselves that we try to honor the blueprint from the very, very beginning.
How many pieces, how many individuals will be playing with you in the symphony?
This weekend we have, I think, 55 players on this program. So it's kind of on the medium to large size. In the Beethoven, of course, there are no trombones or tubas or an extended percussion section, this being an earlier work symphony. But in the Borodin, that's Russian symphony, he adds those three trombones and a tuba, a more generous percussion section, and so it's going to be a bit more full.
Trombones. So there were trombones in his time, Borodin's time, when he was writing?
That's right.
And if I sort of thought that was a new instrument.
There are varieties of that instrument. There are earlier variations. Even in the time of Bach, they call these trombones, these early instruments, sackbuts.
I wish that name had lasted.
Exactly. and they tended to accompany choral works. They were vocal instruments. So there were tenor trombones and bass trombones and alto trombones, and they doubled the alto voices and the tenor voices and the bass voices. In Borodin's time, and as the instrument became more more strong and more modern, as we move to the 19th century, the instrument became more powerful and more used as a harmonic force and a structural force because it was just so strong. In comparison to a group of violins or a group of violas. So Borodin actually adds a lot of weight when he adds those trombones.
We'll get to Borodin in a minute after this next break, but I was looking at pictures of Beethoven, and of course, as a young man, it doesn't look like Beethoven. As a kid, a teenager, it doesn't look like anything. It just looks like a painting.
That's right.
But there's the iconic pictures of Beethoven that we associate with him. He's in middle age, and he's got that intense glare and scowl on his face. He's being very German that day, whatever they were doing that day.
Yeah,
was that who he was?
It was. I mean, have you seen any image where Beethoven is smiling?
No.
You don't see that, and thus you hear that in his music. But are there any images where you see Mozart smiling? Yes, there are all kinds of images, yeah. And even though he only lived to 35, you know, he put out so much music, and all of it just seems to have this youthful energy and smile to it. Beethoven, you know, you think he was composing with hammers and chisels and barbed wire.
Well, so some people do compose like that.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think that's one of the...
Wagner uses a lot of fire and brimstone.
Exactly. But I think that's probably why we are drawn to Beethoven, because it has this kind of raucous style. And at the same time, he can be lovely and lyrical at once. But I always think of Beethoven's music as using rhythm as the germ. You know, da 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 dee, da 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 dee. You know, that's really not a fully formed melody. You know,
no.
It just really has a rhythmic identity: short, 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 long. And I'm talking about the Fifth Symphony. So most of his music starts with some sort of rhythmic germ or rhythmic nuts, and from that, a great work is produced.
It's simple, but it's big, and you can use it in a lot of dynamic ways.
Honestly, it's like rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, rock and roll has all kinds of ostinatos where they repeat a rhythmic identity over and over and over again. You'll hear that many times in Beethoven's music.
And like rock and roll, Beethoven liked his volume, right? He liked to use the orchestra to its fullest.
Right. If you look at Bach's music, he almost never wrote a dynamic marking. It was up to the musician to infer that based on tradition. And Mozart, you know, he maybe used two markings, a piano and a forte. In Beethoven, you see a wider range, a PP, P, MP, MF, F, FF. So he's really trying to define several more tiers of dynamics.
So FF is set on 11, is that it?
Yes, exactly, right.
We're talking with Nicholas Cowilly. He's the music director and the conductor for the Wenatchee Valley Symphony. Is it this weekend we're doing everything?
Yep, this Saturday is the performance.
Tomorrow? Let's sell some tickets. How do the people get in to see you?
Yeah, you can go get some tickets at the door, which is not recommended, as many of our shows sell out. Go to our website, WenatcheeValleySymphony.org, or go to the Numerica Pack website, and you can find tickets there.
When we come back, we'll examine the work of Alexander Borodin, who apparently had a couple careers going and then became famous for something that he did in his hobby time.
The Agenda with Michael Knight on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
12:36. The symphony's playing this weekend, tomorrow, in fact. You want to get tickets? You want to see the show? You really should. It's Beethoven's Second Symphony, and it's also the work of Alexander Borodin, who I'm getting to know better. How do I learn these things? Well, Nicholas Cowilly, the maestro of the symphony, the conductor and the music director, is my guest today. How did you find out about Borodin? When did you first discover him, and why do you like his works?
Well, in terms of Russian composers, we usually go to, you know, people like Shostakovich and Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky first. Then in, of course, music history, you learn about these lesser-known composers like Cesar Cui, well, Mussorgsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, and this composer, Borodin.
Who's the one that wrote Peter and the Wolf?
Prokofiev.
Prokofiev, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, Borodin kind of occupies, you know, a place in Russian history. He was part of a group that wanted to define themselves outside of Western classical tradition. They didn't want to be Beethoven. They didn't want to be Brahms. They wanted to be their own kind of thing. And so they were trying to write Russian music. This is, goes against their compatriots like Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, who were at the St. Petersburg Conservatory writing symphonies and string quartets and chamber music, just like Beethoven and Brahms. But Mussorgsky, Cui, Rimsky-Korsakov, Borodin, they wanted to write something that had a true Russian identity.
Do you like his work? You must. You've chosen him.
Yes. And actually, all Russian music tends to play well to audiences and tends to play well for musicians because they're very pretty. The music is pretty and also very rewarding to play.
Borodin was many things. He was a chemist. He was a surgeon. He was a doctor. He was apparently somebody with a shrew for a wife, apparently, according to Charles Bukowski. But he was not one thing. He was many things. And I guess, what do you call that these days? A polymath? Someone who can just, who whatever he turns his hand to, it turns out to be gold?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, just a brilliant person.
And did he, I mean, I guess he took his composing seriously, even though it was a bit of a hobby at first. When did he realize that he was a factor?
Well, this is probably one of the aspects of this this movement of what they call the Russian Five or the Mighty Hand, these five composers that want to do Russian music, is that you didn't need to have formal Viennese, German training to be a good composer.
How dare you, sir?
Exactly. And so you actually see this kind of less refined style in his compositions. It just didn't have this powdered wig kind of feel to it. Instead, it felt folksy. You know, there's pentatonic scales. There are Russian Orthodox chants that are embedded into it. You know, some of the transitions aren't quite right. Some of the time signatures change here and there. The dynamics aren't as coordinated as some of Beethoven's works. So this was worn as a badge of honor to compose in this style because, well, this is not German. This is Russian.
A good point. Not only that, but a lot of people who tried to get back to their own roots ended up writing classical music based on the folk music of whatever country they happened to be in.
That's right. Dvorak, even Bach, Chopin, Mozart, this idea that...
Was it Brahms who wrote the Hungarian dances?
The Hungarian dances.
Yeah.
That were collecting this oratory tradition, music that you hear sung on the streets, music that you hear sung in the fields, and putting that into classical music. You'll see that in Borodin's, especially his slow movements, a great Russian song.
I think one thing that I can't believe about your performances with the symphony orchestra is how few rehearsals you have. Because everybody knows the music, everybody can read, everybody can follow the charts, everybody's on the same page, and everybody's got this great talent that they've developed over the years. Well, if you had a rock and roll band that had to play for an hour, it would take 3 weeks of practice for everyone to memorize the piece and get it all right and get the time and the elements and the dynamics right. How do you master that so quickly?
You know, it depends on the orchestra. You know, my CW Symphony, we rehearse over 10 weeks because we're really trying to polish and create something special. And it's also an educational environment. You know, professional orchestras, they do, you know, Seattle Symphony will put together a program in just 4 or even 3 rehearsals. We reached a point with our routine here with the Wenatchee Valley Symphony. Yes, we have members who are also professionals in the field, lawyers, doctors, teachers, people that work for the city, but they are also very, very strong musicians. And so we are able to come together and in just 4 rehearsals, put together these programs.
You've probably studied or conducted or worked with the Second Symphony of Beethoven more than once. Is it true that a piece like this will reveal something new to you every time you do it?
It does, because you're constantly... I mean, first of all, I came to this work... I mean, when they give you the conductor starter kit, they give you a dictionary, an instrumentation book, but also, you know, the 9 symphonies. So, I look at this set of symphonies quite often, and especially, number 2. But, you know, as I've grown as a conductor, as I've, had more experience with many, many orchestras, I look at these scores differently. And before I looked at its structure and its qualities and how he puts things together. Now I look at these things and think, oh, how am I going to pace this music, you know, to achieve a very, very satisfying moment or a climax or a diminuendo? Because what the score doesn't tell you is the rate of change. It tells you when to change or when to do something differently, but it doesn't tell you at what pace that should happen. So you have a ritardando. How quickly do you do that ritardando? If you have a crescendo, well, how immediately do you become loud? So those are the kinds of things I think about now as a conductor.
And how many times would you practice a crescendo just going over that one section?
It depends. sometimes I'll say it verbally that this crescendo needs to kind of emerge later. Or I'll say, you know, the crescendo needs to start with the bass section. But a lot of times I like to show those moments just in my being, in my body. So when I see a crescendo approaching, I'm already cognizant about, okay, how am I going to tense my shoulders? How am I going to move a little bit more with resistance? How am I going to which section will I kind of stare to inspire more intensity? A lot of different varieties of how I would practice a crescendo.
Now, the orchestra, 55 strong or whatever it is, they don't look at you, but they can all see you. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, I'm very cognizant about that, too, that there's a they're seeing me out of the periphery. You know, the woodwinds are looking straight at me. And, of course, my first violins, who are to my left, and my cellos, who are to my right, they're kind of seeing me from a profile standpoint. So I understand that I'm giving information that's getting absorbed in a filtered way. So I know when I want to get 100% attention from a particular group of instruments, and I know where I can give kind of peripheral or inferred information to a group that's looking at me not directly.
That's why they call him the maestro. He's up front. That's the voice of Nicholas Cowley, the conductor of the Wenatchee Valley Symphony. This weekend, starting tomorrow, Ludwig von Beethoven and Alexander Borodin, their music, and we'll be back to talk with Nicholas right after this.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
2600, or drop into our new office at 1108 Springwater.
The Agenda with Michael Knight on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
12:51 here at News Radio 560 KPQ. The show is called The Agenda. Special guest today is Nicholas Cowley. He's the conductor and the musical director for the Wenatchee Valley Symphony Orchestra. Their performance tomorrow night includes Beethoven and Borodin, and also a pre-show comment by you yourself.
Yeah, this has become one of our more popular events beyond the concert itself. 1 hour before the concert at 6 p.m., I do a pre-concert chat or talk, and I got to talk a little bit about the music, kind of like we were doing right now. And I also invite the guest artists who might be playing on the show. In fact, tomorrow we're featuring a violinist, Rachel Patrick, and she's playing a concerto by an American composer living, Kevin Putz, who recently won the Pulitzer Prize for his opera Silent Night, based on some stories from World War II. This concerto that we're doing is incredible. Kevin Putz has always been inspired by rock and roll, and so his music actually contains sounds and themes from Bjork, from Dave Matthews Band, from Radiohead, and you'll hear some of that music in the concerto today. Tomorrow at the performance. So yes, come to those pre-concert talks at 6 p.m. They're heavily attended, probably 150 to 200. Come to those talks before the 7 p.m. show.
It's like a lecture right in the theater. A lecture being sort of a dry way to describe it. It's more like a completely different level of entertainment, a way to understand the music in a new way.
Yeah, I call it a preview. You know, it's a way for you to kind of develop an understanding of the music before you hear it. And sometimes I talk about the music, sometimes I talk about conducting, sometimes I talk about the shape of the season, sometimes I talk about the trajectory of the orchestra. It's really a great time to just chat about the arts and in general.
Be a good time to get familiar with Beethoven's music if you don't know it. His Second Symphony is top of the bill. Tell us how to get tickets, Nicholas.
Oh, so again, go to WenatcheeValleySymphony.org. You can find tickets there, links to ways to buy the tickets. But you can also go to the the Numerica Performing Arts Center website and find tickets there.
And how many times? This is one night only?
This is a one-night show, Saturday night. If by chance you can't make it to our show tomorrow night, then I'd invite you to come see another performance. Our next set of performances will be our Nutcracker, which occurs in the second weekend of December.
And we have you scheduled to be here on the 7th of December, so we'll have an opportunity to talk about that. Pearl Harbor Day. At any rate, the show is tomorrow night, one night only. The symphony is in town. Don't miss Borodin and also Beethoven. Thanks a lot for being here, Maestro.
Thank you.
Nicholas Cowley, director, music director, and conductor of the Wenatchee Valley Symphony Orchestra.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.